please call 503-231-8032 to verify if a meeting is being held.
Hello, KBOO members. Thank you for being part of our amazing community. It takes all of us to manage this great community resource, and the role played by the KBOO Board of Directors is essential. Here's an opportunity for you to join the KBOO Board and become part of the team that is guiding our daily work and representing the interests and visions of all of our members. Please consider applying to become a KBOO Board member if you want to help serve our community and put your gifts and talents to good use. There is a time commitment of about 15 hours a month for all board members, and you must be a KBOO member. To apply, go to kboo.fm and fill out an application, or stop by the station to pick up a paper copy. The deadline to apply is July 13, 2019. We are looking for folks who love KBOO, who are committed to our community, and who want to carry forward KBOO's values of peace, justice, democracy, human rights, multiculturalism, environmentalism, freedom of expression, and social change. KBOO needs you. Apply today.
And this is KBOO Portland, and it is 10, it's getting up on 10:01 a.m. We're going to hear Madness Radio bringing you voices and visions from outside mental health. And at 10:30, film at 11, Mona and DK discuss Midsommar. I'm guessing on the pronunciation there. The new film from Hereditary director Ari Aster, and other releases, revivals, and television programs. At 11, Pacific Underground features an interview with City of Portland Communications Manager Jeff Selby about what it's like to work in public service. And then you know it's coming up at noon. All the way till 10 p.m., we're bringing you nothing but the Waterfront Blues Festival. Indeed, we got our crew there bringing you part of what we all love. Mm-hmm. All of this can only happen with the support of the community, and that's you, my friends. That's you going to kboo.fm, and that's you clicking on donate. That's you going to the mobile app and tapping the little maroon square with the yellow letters that says donate. Because that's how this works, y'all. And now, as promised, this is Madness Radio.
What does it mean to be called crazy in a crazy world? Listen to Madness Radio, voices and visions from outside mental health. An affiliate of Mad in America Radio, broadcasting on KBOO in Oregon, sponsored by Portland Hearing Voices and the Icarus Project, and syndicated on the Pacifica Network. Madness Radio is online at kboo.fm/madnessradio and at madinamerica.com. Welcome to Madness Radio. This is your host, Will Hall. Today, my guest is Rachel Jane Liebert. Rachel is a PhD lecturer in psychology at the University of East London in the UK. She collaborates with artists and activists on decolonizing and feminist work around madness and whiteness. Her new book is Psychurity: Colonialism, Paranoia, and the War on Imagination. So welcome to Madness Radio, Rachel Jane Liebert.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Yeah, I'm really interested in your work, and your book, Psychurity, is quite remarkable. It brings together both a careful and detailed critique of what's called the early psychosis movement, or the early psychosis intervention approach in psychology, which is trying to treat madness at its earliest, or even, you know, preventing it from happening. It combines a critique of that along with a larger political understanding, and also a spiritual and a very creative and artistic understanding. So it's a very remarkable book, and I encourage people to check it out.
Thank you.
How did you get interested in these topics? You grew up in New Zealand, which is a colonized country, and so I imagine these issues were very alive for you in your life growing up. And then how did you get interested in psychology, and specifically in looking at the new approaches, the emerging approaches that are happening around psychosis?
Well, I mean, when I was back in New Zealand doing my kind of undergraduate degree in psychology, I was extremely disappointed in my experiences. In fact, I dropped out. I remember saying to people at the time that I felt like psychology took the human out of being human. And then I kind of reluctantly went back and finished it and just kind of rote learned everything and just kind of got out of there as quickly as I could. I got into psychology because I was really curious about and really into just people generally, just how different we all are in people's stories, lives, how we affect each other. And then when I was in the university, it felt like everyone just got reduced to a category, sometimes a kind of theoretical category, sometimes a diagnosis, and that our job was just to memorize not only that name of that category, but the name of the person who first designated it in the year that they did so. Uh-huh. And it just felt like a very soulless way of engaging with people. And so, yeah, so I got through it and got out of there as soon as I could and jumped into working in community mental health and in particular doing anti-discrimination work around madness. I was co-facilitating a youth group for young people, young adults who were using mental health service. And we kind of put together these workshops to go out in the community and challenge discrimination around madness. And in doing so, we found that we had to challenge the dominance of this kind of medical script. So very quickly, that work became about kind of challenging medicalization, but also because it was in the context of Aotearoa New Zealand, and a lot of the people we worked with were Indigenous people and who were also helping us to pull together these workshops, we started to kind of tie together medicalization and colonization. And so I think that's how I first started to kind of orient myself to thinking in terms of taking a kind of decolonizing approach to psychology.
We tend to think of medicine as benevolent, that we're here to help people, that it's about caring, that it's about offering beneficial services, it's about the interests of the people who are suffering. But then if we look at the history of colonialism, that's actually what Christianity was doing all throughout colonialism. The people who arrived in New Zealand weren't necessarily, I'm sure some of them were, but they weren't necessarily motivated by a hatred and an explicit kind of wanting to destroy a culture. They felt themselves as a modernizing or civilizing or Christianizing force for good. And I think that's one of the things that we have to remember, that often the worst kinds of violence and evil are done in the name of help and caring and doing good in the world.
I know, yeah. As you started speaking, the first thing to come into my mind was like, yeah, those were my very helpful ancestors who on my mother's side were missionaries who helped to colonize Aotearoa New Zealand in the name of good and the civil. So for me, keeping my kind of ancestral lines close is really important in doing this work. Especially, you know, as a kind of white person myself, it's like, how do I make sure that I'm just not being a white savior? How do I make sure that I'm just not kind of helping in a way that's ignoring the kind of agency of the people that I work with, or my own kind of complicity in coloniality?
Yeah, the white savior image and the doctor as savior are very closely related. I mean, would you say that that's what you were being set up to do in your psychology training, as you were being kind of formed as another version of the white savior, except now you are working in the context of psychology rather than in the context of religion or Christianity or explicit imperialism?
Yeah, I think that really resonates. And part of that is looking at our kind of how our diagnostic categories, how our diagnostic practices are themselves enacting these kind of colonial dynamics.
And how does that work? I mean, I think that there's a very interesting connection between what gets defined as normal and what are the expected behaviors of a white man, that being white and male sort of creates the definition of what it is to be mentally healthy and to be mentally normal. They're actually very closely related standards.
Yeah. And that can be traced back through colonization. I mean, there's a Caribbean philosopher who I'm really influenced by, who named Sylvia Winter. And she talks about how the kind of the core of colonization is what she calls the de-supernaturalization of our modes of being human. And that Western intellectuals kind of went out from the 15th century, went out into parts of what we now know as Asia and Africa and Oceania, and kind of started to declare like a certain kind of rationality as the superior kind of rationality. And that is one, you know, where we are not enslaved, in her terms, to our emotions, where we're cut off from our bodies, where we're cut off from the land, cut off from each other. And instead we kind of slowly, it's like our whole being moves up into the mind, and it's from there that we just kind of can know and control the world. And so anyone who deviates from that is eventually considered mad. To me, that's where psychiatric survivor movements and mad justice movements really align so importantly with kind of Black resistance movements, feminist movements, Indigenous movements, because that certain kind of man with a capital M, rational knowing man, was absolutely gendered, absolutely raced, absolutely classed. And so any kind of bodies that represented another way of being in the world were literally murdered, wiped out.
And so in your new book, Psychurity, what you've done is kind of focus on one aspect of contemporary psychiatry and psychology, which is this interest in treating and helping people seen as psychotic, but in the very, very early stages. There's a bunch of research that's called the prodromal stage. It's like a fancy way of saying earliest, the moments when you start to get symptoms before you have symptoms. So in other words, psychiatry is interested in treating people who are in a crisis, but it's also interested in people who are not in a crisis, but they think are going to be in a crisis at some point in the future. And this has a lot of problems with it because it kind of expands the net. It expands the reach of psychiatric services, again, in the name of helping people and being preventative and supporting people at the early stages. But as your book really points out, it has this incredible dark side to it. So tell us about the Psychurity book and your kind of focus on this prodromal early psychosis question.
Yeah, at the time when I started doing the research, it was 9/11 was very much in the air. I mean, it was about 10 years post 9/11. But living in New York, it was very much in the everyday kind of landscape where every time I kind of left the building. And so I became really curious into how these kind of politics of terror were moving through these new approaches to madness, and in particular to psychosis, because there was this language of kind of preventing these future threats and therefore having to put in place these security measures that were seen to be very, very logical. And they not only seemed to kind of save money over time, but as you said, they were seen to be, with regards to madness, they were seen to be as particularly kind of compassionate because they're preventing people from any pending kind of pain and trauma. So this to me was echoing with, well, I think in particular of the kind of Homeland Security slogan, if you see something, say something. And actually that slogan started to come through when I started to look into this prodromal movement. So I remember there was I started to do kind of an ethnography of these shifts to identify and intervene on psychosis, and before it became a problem, is the way people described it.
So what you're saying is that in a sense society perceives a threat, and it's a threat from the terrorists, but it's also a threat from the psychotic person.
Yeah.
It's basically the same kind of framing of fear and danger and threat. And so just like there's a law enforcement and military approach to perceiving when terrorism might be starting at its early stages, there's also a whole psychology psychiatry approach, which is looking for when madness will begin at its early stages.
Well, yeah, and also I mean, what I became interested in was how this kind of movement was helping to defend kind of America, and I say that in inverted commas, America itself, because what I was noticing was that when there were these shootings, mass shootings that were happening, like, for example, the Dylann Roof shooting, which I talk about in the book, it happened in 2015. Those actions of those kind of white supremacist shooters, there's a concerted effort to try and frame that person as an individual mad person, because that stops us from looking at these cultures of coloniality, of patriarchy, of militarism that actually create the conditions of possibility for those shootings in the first place. So I was interested in how things, this supposedly objective prodromal science, was playing a role in these much bigger, very, very violent politics. And one thing that stood out to me and has stuck with me was looking back over kind of some archives and finding George Bush's response to 9/11 all the way back in 2001, and how he actually names kind of mental health and this kind of intervention work in mental health as he talks about pulling together soldiers and the armies of compassion to kind of to make America a better place for people with disabilities, including people considered to have mental health issues. And so, and he's saying that as a response to 9/11. So it's like, yeah, so there was this connection that seemed to be brewing, and I wanted in my book to kind of dive into that.
And as part of that, you did some very close on the ground work with looking at what clinics around early psychosis are doing and the kinds of training and the kinds of language that we're doing. Because we should say that this is something that's happening throughout the United States. It's actually being generalized as a model around the world that, you know, there are these young people, and if we get them help early, then we can prevent them having more of a crisis later. And it sounds good, and I think there is some truth. Obviously, you want to give help
actions
early. There's no
madness,
objection to that, but you're saying that it's been twisted into this kind of almost paranoid military security response of anticipating, preventing, and controlling.
Yeah, and so I did. I wanted to get right into the laboratories of this kind of prodromal science and to learn what they did, to learn the kind of the cogs of it is how I come to talk about them in my book and detail the cogs. So I contacted a few prodromal clinics on the East Coast and ended up spending time with one in particular and kind of shadowed one of their lead coordinators of the research. And that involved me, first of all, going and kind of watching as she did a presentation at a school to the kind of counselors and teachers and administrative staff about what kind of signs they might look out for in young people who are potentially psychotic.
So again, it's the if you see something, say something kind of mentality. Yeah. And the idea is that you report the person. You see that they're acting potentially distressed or they've got something unusual, and then you report them to the authorities. But in this context, it's the mental health professionals.
Yeah, in this case, the authority is the university that houses this research clinic. And then young people would be referred to this clinic where they would go through a screening process to see whether or not they might be prodromal. So again, prodromal means potentially psychotic. Potentially.
It's a little bit like a thought crime. Like you haven't really done the crime yet, but you're thinking about it, and so we're going to predict you're going to do it. So we're going to intervene on you.
Yeah. So then I participated in a training day to learn how to actually do this screening of young people. And so during the training, I kind of documented how kind of young people pulled in for this supposedly banal, quite benevolent screening were actually made prodromal. I really believe that actually, that these kind of objective measures weren't just kind of representing people's experiences, but they were actually turning people's experiences into something that was a problem.
How do you see that operating? Because it's almost like an expectation effect that happens, that the people just get brought in and then they're expected to behaving a certain way and then they end up fulfilling that expectation.
Yeah. I mean, there are lots of very kind of subtle ways that all kind of came together. So one is in terms of like the kind of the screening questionnaire that's used is kind of is structured, because that seemed, meaning that they asked the same questions in the same order every single time with every single young person. And that seemed to be more quote unquote scientific, because it seemed to remove kind of any bias of the person who is doing the screening. However, what that does is it actually kind of bullies people's experiences into these predetermined categories, because effectively people need to start answering yes or no to all these questions. The way the kind of questioning is done is kind of like interrogation of the young person, and in such a way that ultimately it felt like they had no place to go except to become prodromal.
What were some of the kinds of questions that they're asking in these interviews of young people to sort of detect incipient psychosis lurking around the person?
These are direct kind of word for word from the screening instrument that people use. Is, have you had the feeling that something odd is going on, or that something is wrong that you can't explain? Have you ever been confused at times whether something you have experienced is real or imaginary? Do familiar people or surroundings ever seem strange? Does your experience of time seem to have changed? Do you ever seem to live through events exactly as you have experienced them before? And those ones, for example, are all considered to kind of tap into whether or not people have what they call unusual thought content or delusional ideas. And so the prodromal clinics, they're not allowed to say that they give treatment. They have to say that they're just giving research. But effectively, they talk actually quite openly that they're actually working ultimately to try and treat people. And once people start becoming treated, then it's almost like their kind of their psyches and their bodies become attuned to being this idea of being psychotic. And people have to spit in test tubes, they have to go through brain scans, they have to make all these kind of lifestyle interventions, and eventually, yeah, like some people are put on antipsychotics. And it's all in the name of kind of research, and maybe this is because you might be prodromal, but ultimately they kind of come to, I think, convince psyches and bodies that they are prodromal and that psychosis is right there.
So you're talking about something that happens throughout the mental health system, is the socialization into a new identity, that you've been a normal, ordinary participant in the community, but now you gradually, slowly get drawn in to where you have a new self-understanding, where actually you see yourself as different. You see yourself as psychotic or as prodromally psychotic, and then that ends up starting to change who you are, and you become the very thing that you're being expected to be.
Well, yeah, and there's like, again, there's kind of these small, like, but very concrete and powerful kind of moments within in the clinic where you see this happening. So one is a very kind of well-known trope, which is that if people start to not want to take medication and not want to be involved in kind of treatment, then that's seen as a symptom actually of like their lurking psychosis.
Yeah, it's considered a kind of paranoia. Like, why don't you trust us? We're just trying to help you. Why are you resisting this offer of, you know, why are you not having insight into what's really going on here? And then you very quickly get a polarization that just fuels the whole paranoia dynamic.
Yeah, exactly. So it's this spiraling starts to happen. And spirals become a very central motif in the book. It's like how we get pulled into these spirals.
What you're describing is that in a sense, it kind of works the way military paranoia works, because in military paranoia, you're afraid of potential enemies. So you get on guard, you get defensive, and then your defensiveness and your on guardness ends up provoking people. And then they react, and then you point and say, ah, yes, I was right. There really are potential enemies out there. And then the whole dynamic starts to happen.
And then the kind of added twist to it is that because the treatments that they're giving people are supposedly these like preventative interventions, it means that actually this like this future threat of psychosis can never be falsified, because there's this argument, well, once people start taking these preventative treatments, there's no evidence that it was never going to happen. So that's part of the spiraling that happens. So actually, once people start engaging in treatment, their psychosis, their future psychosis, becomes eternally real. And that's why this prodromal movement and these kind of broader security industries are extremely problematic, because they just spiral outwards and outwards and just create a bigger and bigger market for what they do.
Well, what you're describing is something that's parallel with the war on terror, because we know the terror is out there. So we have all this spending against terror. The terror hasn't happened. Well, it's because we're spending all this money on anti-terror. There's no way to actually confirm that you're preventing the terrorist threat because you're attacking it. So it's just this endless spiral that just continues and continues, that's fueled by the paranoia without any kind of evidence.
Yeah, after kind of going in and documenting all these cogs, that's where I kind of started to turn towards in the book, because it was like, well, this is driven by paranoia. What is driving these cogs? It seems like it's paranoia. And so I come to kind of theorize this paranoia and how it actually is like very present in science, including in psychology and these kind of prodromal movements, and thinking about what are the kind of roots of this paranoia and how does it itself kind of enact this broader neo-colonial security state, which we see one instance of it in the war on terror. What started off as kind of looking at how these prodromal scientists who are ostensibly trying to kind of document and capture paranoia are actually driven by their own paranoia. And in doing that kind of analysis, I came across the work of Eve Sedgwick, who's a queer theorist, and she talks about how critical scholarship tends towards its own paranoia, in that we can kind of just document the world as this like oppressive force that just kind of gets bigger and bigger and worse and worse, and that in itself can be quite a suffocating experience for those of us who are trying to make change. And so I wanted to switch in the book from away from doing a paranoid reading towards doing what she calls a reparative reading, that is looking for places of kind of hope and radicality, in my case of decolonial possibility within paranoia itself. And that's where I started to connect experiences of paranoia with imagination. That within paranoia is this potential for imagination, for otherworldly correspondence, and that potential, that capacity, gets deformed or twisted into paranoia within a neo-colonial security state. And so in terms of thinking about how paranoia is so omnipresent and so problematic in terms of these kind of post 9/11 politics of terror, it's like, is there some way that we can kind of return this much more kind of radical capacity or potential within paranoia? How can we make space for imagination within a paranoid world?
Why is it that, help us understand this, why is it that someone who embraces imagination, who connects with ancestors, who connects with spirits, and has a kind of a magical perspective on the world, why is that a challenge to white supremacy? Why is that not just one flavor of whiteness, for example?
That's a lovely question. Yeah, earlier I spoke about how this person called Sylvia Winter talks about how colonization emerged out of this desupernaturalization of our modes of being human. So to me, like, part of kind of challenging the subsequent dehumanization that came out of colonization and that exists now and it enables all these conditions of violence is actually if we can welcome back in these modes of being human that are supernaturalized, right? That are not, where our connection to the cosmos is no longer severed. So challenging this idea of what's rational, which is, as I see, like, embedded and absolutely central to science, to academia, to psychology, is this idea of what's rational, what's good scholarship, you know? So if we can challenge that, I believe that we're challenging something that's at the core of coloniality and this kind of cosmological violence that continues today. If we can start to kind of, in terms of doing decolonizing work and maybe other kinds of radical kind of politics or seeking other kinds of radical change, is really looking at the world. I think it's more from a more kind of spiritual perspective, but really seeing that there is this kind of this otherworldly potential, that this other world is possible, not just in the future, but it's actually with us here and now, that there is decolonial in the colonial. And it's about kind of looking for those seeds and nourishing them, collectively nourishing them.
Rachel, remind us about your book and how can people get in touch with you if they want to get in touch with you?
Well, my book is called Psychurity, Colonialism, Paranoia, and the War on Imagination. And people can get in touch with me by email. So the address is rachel.liebert@gmail.com. That's rachel.liebert@gmail.com.
Rachel Jane Liebert, thank you so much for joining us today on Madness Radio.
And thank you, dear listener, for joining us here at KBOO Portland, where it's coming upon time for Film at 11, which is on at 10:30. And at 11 is Pacific Underground, featuring an interview with City of Portland Communications Manager Jeff Selby about what it's like to work in public service. And I'll remind y'all again that at noon, we're bringing you the Waterfront Blues Festival. All of today's program from the two main stages from noon until 10. That's coming up. And then we get to the point where I remind you, in accordance with my contractual obligations, that KBOO programming is made possible by KBOO member listeners and support from Dark Side Cinema. Open every night and featuring independent foreign and art house films. The Dark Side is located at 215 Southwest 4th Street between Madison and Jefferson Avenues in Corvallis, Oregon. More information and showtimes online at darksidecinema.com.